This is Mark Strassman, a reporter with Utopia News Network. We're about to talk to Dr. David Goodstein, who's just written a book called Out of Gas. Welcome to Utopia Book News Network.
Thank you.
I've never read a book that was so completely and concisely characterized by its title as this one. I mean, that's the story.
That's the story, that's right.
But you did go on for many educational and entertaining pages to talk about it. What exactly is the problem? Gas may be up to $2.17 on the average here in Los Angeles, but isn't there plenty to go on forever?
No, there certainly isn't plenty to go on forever. The only question is, when are we going to run out? Because we certainly must run out.
Well, what are the ranges of opinion on that? What are the most optimistic people say is the time that we're going to run out?
Well, first of all, to define terms, run out does not mean pump the last drop of oil. It means when the oil fields start to get depleted faster than we can replace them.
Okay, explain why that's the point we need to worry about rather than when we run out completely.
That's when the supply will start to decline. And there's no reason to believe that demand will not continue to increase as it has for well over a century. And so a gap will grow between what's available and what's needed. That at the very least, will drive the price way up. And then whether we can go on living as we do will depend very much on whether we can find substitutes and at what price.
Okay, when you say way up, people consider $2 way up. What do you consider? What do you consider way up?
$2 a gallon is 50 cents a liter. That's less than half what we pay a bottle of drinking water.
Right.
Europeans, when they come to this country, are always astonished to find that gasoline is the cheapest fluid you can buy in the United States.
Right.
So way up does not mean $2 a gallon.
Well, there's a lot of science. There aren't a lot of numbers in your book.
No, and I can't make any prediction for what gas will cost at the pump next month or next year. I can give you the big picture, the fact that there is evidence that the peak will occur sooner than most people believe, and why that's true. I can also tell you why one should be skeptical of any particular prediction, because the numbers are not very dependable. But I can't tell you what the price of gas is going to be next week.
Okay, but in fact, $5, $6, $10, $15 a gallon is under conditions when, if the demand, if I mean, all you need to do is draw some curves, if the supply drops by 20% and the demand remains constant.
We're gonna have a big problem.
Okay. So, what are you recommending or suggesting or telling us that science can tell us about what we need to know about what we might want to do given this situation?
Okay. Very briefly, let me give you a summary of the situation.
Okay.
We have light crude oil, and light crude oil is going to run out. It's impossible for me to tell you whether it's going to run out, whether it's already begun, or it won't happen until later in this decade, or it won't happen until the next decade. It's very important to us to know that, but on the scale of human history, it's absolutely trivial.
Right.
Okay? So it's going to happen. We or our children or our grandchildren are in for some very hard times. Now, when the price of oil goes up, as it will, then people will start looking for substitutes to sell, to manufacture and sell at that higher price.
Right.
In addition to light crude oil, there is heavy oil, which is basically what's left behind in the oil fields after you take the light crude oil out. And then there are oil sands and tar sands. The heavy oil, as they say, is what's left over when you've depleted an oil field. You can always get a little bit more out by advanced technologies. But the more you get out, the heavier it gets.
And of course, all these more advanced technologies require the input of more energy, don't they, to get
more,
the energy out?
More money and more energy.
Right.
Yes, that's right.
And it reaches a point, sort of, where you're losing it. You're losing energy with every barrel, but you hope to make it up in volume. Or
yeah,
something.
That's the kind of thing. Yes, exactly. So to give a very specific example,
right?
There's a tremendous supply of oil sands in Alberta, tremendous reserves of oil sands in Alberta. And they're mining it now, and the pricing mechanism has already kicked in, and they're already mining it at a profit. That is, they're able to manufacture it at less than they get.
Right.
But they are mining it. That is, it's a solid deposit. It gets strip mined, and it gets taken to a plant where the oil is extracted from the sand.
Right.
But the oil that comes out is not rich enough to be made into gasoline, so they have to combine it with hydrogen. And so they have some of the biggest methane reforming plants in the world making hydrogen in northern Alberta. That means you're burning methane to make oil.
Right.
So you're putting more energy in. That's an example of just what you said.
Right. Although the advantage, if you can call it that, is that when you're finished, you've got a product that can be used to fuel automobiles.
That's correct, and that's exactly why it's being done.
Okay. All right. Well, all of that is centered on the fact that people like to drive cars around, which is something that they've really only been doing for about 100 years.
Yes, in fact, the first oil well was drilled 150 years ago, but in that 150 years, approximately, it was in 1859.
Right.
But in that a century and a half, we have evolved a civilization that's firmly rooted in the promise of an endless supply of cheap oil. Everything about the way we build our cities, our roads, the way we design our lives is centered on that promise.
This is why Aldous Huxley labeled the future after Ford in Brave New World.
Right, and now it's going to be after petroleum.
Yes. I would like to focus sort of on the other way of solving the problem, which is to have people drive less.
Yes. So I drive a hybrid. We could all drive hybrids without any loss of convenience or comfort.
Tell people who haven't gotten around to hearing about it yet what a hybrid is.
Well, a hybrid is a car that has both gasoline and electric motors.
Right.
There are a number of different designs out, and the one that I drive, the electric motor, is a booster to the tiny gasoline engine.
Right.
And when it's not being in use as a booster, it's being charged. The batteries are being charged through it.
Right. I had a chance once to drive. I went to the EV1 rollout in El Segundo and drove it back from Pacific Palisades. It had a really fast pickup, and essentially it got a lot of its energy in the batteries from converting the energy of the forward motion that otherwise lost in the braking into the electrical system.
Yes.
And that's what hybrids do as well,
right?
That's what
hybrids do as well. But the EV1, which I also drove,
right.
The onboard computer, when it was freshly charged, said that you had a range of 30 miles.
Right.
Although they claimed it was 50 to 100. Today we have much better batteries than we had in those days. The lithium-ion batteries that are used in cell phones and laptops have five times the energy density of the batteries that we use in the original EV1.
So that means it even means that an EV1 with those better batteries might have been more successful.
Yes, yes, that's true. Although there are still huge problems, advanced batteries are a reality.
Okay. So the hybrids that are out now enable essentially a doubling of mileage?
Essentially, yeah, approximately that.
Okay.
Right.
And are they any more expensive to build than...
I think they're much more expensive to build. They're heavily subsidized. My understanding is that my Honda Insight cost $100,000 to build. I pay $21,000 for it.
You got a bargain.
Yeah, it's a bargain.
So are you saying that these hybrids are not a real substantial opportunity for solving any of these problems?
No, I think they are. I think as the technology improves, as the mass market increases, and as economies of scale drive the cost down, I think that we'll see more and more hybrids.
And by doubling the mileage, then is that a pretty straight line calculation that it would double the time until the oil ran out?
No, it's not. It's not
or is
quite
it better or worse? Or
no, it's not that good.
It's not that
it
good.
It would soften the blow.
It would soften the blow. All right. And the idea of softening the blow or extending the period of time until the oil runs out is to allow for the creation of alternative energy sources.
It just gives us more time to get in alternatives. But if the alternatives are fossil fuels, which they're very likely to be because that's the easiest, most convenient.
The low-hanging fruit.
That's
so
the low-hanging fruit. We are then putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere with unpredictable consequences.
So in addition to having the problem of running out of oil and having everything come to a stop, using the fossil fuels is also going to potentially wreak havoc on the environment.
Exactly.
In massive and unpredictable ways.
Yes, yes.
So you're recommending that it would be a good idea to get off the oil addiction faster rather than wait till the end.
If we had visionary, courageous leadership, national and world leadership, they would challenge us to kick the fossil fuel habit now when we don't yet have to do it.
Right. Well, why don't we talk about that a little bit? Why isn't... What would that visionary leadership say?
The physics is very simple.
Okay.
If you're not going to use fossil fuel, there are only two other possible sources of energy. They are sunlight and nuclear.
Okay.
Either one is a huge challenge. To replace the fossil fuel burn rate today, just ignoring the increasing world population, the fact that the people in China and India would like to use more energy and live more like we do and so on.
Right.
Just taking today's burn rate, fossil fuel, in order to replace it with nuclear energy, you'd have to build 10,000 of the largest nuclear plants you could possibly build. I'm talking about nuclear fission energy, the kind that we know how to do.
Right. Think of the zoning hearings.
And just think of that, but 10,000.
Right.
Okay? If you'd like to replace it instead with sunlight, the gold standard for sunlight is photovoltaics.
Right.
So silicon photovoltaics at 10% efficiency would require 220,000 square kilometers. That's about half the size of the state of California. And although the amount of land is not beyond imagination,
right,
all of the photovoltaics ever made would probably cover less than 10 square kilometers.
Well, for example, I want to get too specific here, or imaginary, but isn't there a sort of convergence of places that have a lot of sand that are deserted and that have a lot of sunlight? I'm thinking of the deserts of North Africa.
Yeah, the Saudi Arabian desert may someday be more valuable for its sunlight than for its oil.
Or even the Mojave.
Right.
Places where essentially the sand could be made into silicon,
yes,
and it could be set up. No one's going to be... And in fact, if you put the stuff 10 feet over the... prop the cells 10 feet over the surface, you could put little greenhouses underneath and, you know, grow cabbages or something.
Now you're talking about the kind of idea that can rescue us in the future.
Okay, well then let's focus on that. I've been making ideas personally, like suggestions like that, for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I ran for Congress in Silicon Valley in 1980 on a platform of compute, don't commute.
Uh-huh.
And I said, wouldn't it be a better idea, instead of driving up and down the 101 and being blocked up every day, to stay home and hook yourself up to a computer? And this was actually before the internet was...
And there are a lot of people doing that today.
And there are a lot of people doing that today, but there are a lot more that aren't. And I'm one. And for example, you're in Pasadena, I guess, right now.
Yeah.
I'm in Los Angeles. We're recording a session. We're going to post it on the internet. We're only paying using the electricity in these systems to do it. I don't have to drive there. You don't have to drive anywhere.
Right.
So on the one hand, isn't that a good model that isn't being followed enough in terms of the way the society is organized?
Absolutely.
You have any ideas that I don't? Being a more
Well, since I wrote the book, I've gotten in the mail lots of ideas from different people, including many things that certainly I hadn't heard of.
Right.
And that really need to be tried. But the point is, we're not investing a big effort in trying to solve this problem.
Okay, well, let's try to figure out why. I've come up with at least two main reasons: the recalcitrance of human nature and the power of corporations that benefit from the status quo.
Yes.
Would those both be...
Both of those are important reasons.
Are there others that I've left out? The basic laws of physics, I suppose, but we can't do anything about those.
We can't do anything about the basic laws of physics.
Right.
But the basic laws of physics are not what defeat us. We could have a civilization as complex and active as ours without using fossil fuels.
Okay, well, why don't we approach each of those two major barriers to that outcome one at a time. First, the recalcitrance of human nature. People like to drive around in big cars, I guess.
They drive around in big cars, and if you tell them the oil is running out, they say, you're wrong. It's said before. And it has been said before. It's the old story of the little boy who cried wolf. What people forget about it is that at the end, the wolf really does come along.
Right. At the end, the wolf does come along. And in fact, I mean, we've only been using this oil for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
It took millions of years to create. Hundreds of millions of years to create.
Mm-hmm.
Who isn't... tens of millions of dollars are being used on television to teach people that if they're nervous at a party, they have social anxiety disorder and they need to buy Paxil. Why isn't that money being used to convince them of the far more dangerous situation that they're not going to be able to get to work or get food if the current patterns are continued?
Well, it was just for this purpose that I wrote the book.
Ah. So, and it's for that purpose that I'm talking to you,
yes,
and I'm going to put this up and encourage people to listen to it. Have you heard anything one way or the other from company? BP is a particularly interesting company, I think, formerly British Petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
About a year ago, 2 years ago, I was all hepped up about providing solar energy and cell phones for Afghanistan. And I ended up talking to people from the BP Solar Energy Department,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
because they seemed to be all gung-ho about it, too. Nothing happened, of course. But they're an oil company that is trying to position themselves as a big solar energy company.
Yeah,
are they doing much to sort of turn the tide there, or what?
There's a former CEO of BP who says that BP used to stand for British Petroleum, but now it stands for Beyond Petroleum.
Yeah, well, but they still keep selling the stuff.
But they still keep
selling
the stuff, and they're one of the biggest companies in the world. Caltech's previous provost, his name is Dr. Stephen Koonin,
right,
just resigned from Caltech and went to BP as its chief scientist.
Okay,
one of the most important energy jobs in the world.
All right, and does he keep in touch with you? Is he telling you?
He keeps in touch with me, and he's read my book.
Oh, but, okay.
But he also sent me an essay by the chief economist. He's the chief scientist.
Right.
Down the hall from him is the chief economist.
Exactly right.
And the chief economist thinks there's no problem.
No problem. Just
no problem. We're not going to run out of oil.
So, well, maybe so he can scatter a few more copies of your book around the offices there. Is Caltech doing any breakthrough research?
We have research. We have a group here called Power the Planet.
It's called what?
Power the Planet.
Right.
And it's doing research tilted towards solar in material science and applied physics, meaning improved photovoltaics.
Right.
And in chemistry. And there's another small group doing fundamental plasma research, which is the essential of what's needed for fusion.
Right.
Now, fusion is, unfortunately, the solution to the problem, but it's been 25 years away for the past 50 years, and it's still 25 years away.
It's sort of the opposite of crying wolf.
Yeah, that's right.
Is there any? Is there some basic engine? Is it a physics problem or an engineering problem or a budget problem?
It's not so much a physics problem. We understand the physics, we don't understand the details of the plasma physics that would allow us to solve the problem of nuclear fusion.
So, in fact,
physics problems to be done.
There is a physics problem. Could a conceptual breakthrough in physics offer some way of if somebody. Can string theory be applied, super string theory, asymmetry theory be applied to this in some way to figure out to make the particles behave in a more convenient way?
You never know when something unexpected will come along out of basic scientific research that will change the landscape completely.
Right.
You just don't know.
Right.
But it's
not on the horizon. It's not on the event horizon.
It's not on the event horizon. That's right.
All right. Well, let's get more down to earth here. How about more taxes on gasoline? Would that be any good?
One of our political parties is currently running an ad against the other political party, saying that he had the temerity to suggest 50 cents a gallon gasoline.
I vaguely remember that. In fact, I think that the Democrats said that, oh no, not me. I mean, they're climbing over each other.
Right.
To deny that they want a gas tax.
Right. Exactly.
So that's not very. I haven't heard from Ralph Nader on this, but he's not likely to win. So
that's right.
How about banning car commercials? Because
we don't have a consensus. We don't have a national consensus that big cars and the use of oil is a bad thing.
Hmm. How about writing a novel in which cars cause a lot of trouble?
I have done the one and only thing that I'm capable of doing, which is to write a book as clearly as possible lays the problem out.
Right, you have.
There are other books, some of them good,
right,
that also lay out this problem, and it's receiving more notice. And it just takes a while for these things to break through.
I guess rationing the mileage that people are entitled to is of equal tenor with a gas tax. It's not going to happen. I came up with a slogan while reading the book. It says, if you're going to live like there's no tomorrow, you'd better hope there isn't.
Not bad.
Yes, okay. Talk about Mr. Hubert.
Hubert.
And what his contribution to this whole thing
well,
is.
Well, he was a geophysicist, and he worked for Shell Oil in Houston. And he looked. There are two separate stories. One of them is the history of discovery, and the other is the history of what the oil industry calls production. But it's not production at all because they don't produce a drop of oil.
Right.
It's really extraction or supply,
right.
If you like.
They call themselves the producers, but they're really the miners.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right. So he looked at the U.S. Oil discovery in Lower 48, peaked in the 1930s. And around 1950, he took a look at the situation and figured out a way of extrapolating the declining rate of discovery and learning how much we will have discovered when we've discovered everything. In other words, how much oil Mother Nature had made for us.
Right.
Okay? Then he said, all right, now we know how much oil there is, and we know the rate at which we've been using it. That also will be a bell-shaped curve, which will have a peak, but it will be later. Can I predict when that peak will be?
Right.
And he did, and he predicted it would be around 1970. This is in 1956 at a time when the U.S. is the world's greatest producer of oil, not the Middle East, the U.S., and much of our military and industrial might depends on our giant oil industry.
Right. So, and in fact, and the place of Texas in the mythology of the country followed from, and the election of Lyndon Johnson, all followed from that particular those facts.
Exactly. So he predicted that it would peak around 1970, and people laughed at him at the time, but around 1970, sure enough, it peaked, and it's been declining ever since.
And by no accident, it was only 3 years later, with a lot of other geopolitical developments, that the first big oil crisis occurred.
Precisely.
Okay. So that's... And was he a prophet without honor in his own time and country?
Well, he's well honored now. I mean, he's very well known among geologists and geophysicists.
Right, okay. He seems like Edwards Demings of his...
Maybe
a
little bit.
Maybe a little bit.
But let me tell you a little story that's not in the book.
Please.
Ken DeFays, who wrote a previous book about Hubbard's Peak, in fact, his book was called Hubbard's Peak.
Right.
He said, he's an oil man, and he said he realized that Hubbard had been right and that the peak had been reached when he saw a line in the San Francisco Chronicle that said, the Texas Railroad Commission has announced 100% allowable for next month.
And that means?
And so you had to be an insider to understand what that means.
Right.
The Texas Oil Commission was the cartel that controlled the oil industry in the United States by strategic use of the excess pumping capacity in Texas.
Like OPEC.
It's exactly like OPEC. And when they said 100% allowable, that meant that they had run out of excess pumping capacity.
Flat out. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the American educated people who created OPEC had studied that commission very thoroughly and
no doubt
how it worked.
And so OPEC took over at that point.
Right.
And I've always thought that the signal for the worldwide peak would come when we learned that Saudi Arabia had peaked.
Right.
Because they have been using through OPEC, but they have been using their excess capacity to manipulate the world's oil market for decades.
Right.
Okay? On February 24th, there was a front-page story in the New York Times that said exactly that had happened.
And in fact, it was the switching of the sort of the epicenter of the of oil mining from Texas to Saudi Arabia that coincided with the real rise of the Middle East as the focal point of the world's geopolitical obsession.
You bet.
Which could have been avoided, of course, if the dependence on oil were not so great.
That's exactly right.
And won't go away until the dependence on oil becomes less.
That's also right. So we have three reasons for kicking the fossil fuel habit. One of them is that we're going to run out of fossil fuel anyway, and we've got to learn how to do it.
Right.
The second is that we're doing unknown damage to the climate.
Right.
And the third is that we're completely dependent on unstable and despotic regimes in the Middle East.
Right, or getting rid of them, or doing business with them, or whatever.
Precisely.
Okay. Although you're loath to get into the specifics of it, one book that came to mind as I was reading yours was Jonathan Schell's Fate of the Earth, in which the post-nuclear world is a pretty bad place to be in.
Mm-hmm.
How would you compare a worst-case scenario under in out of gas with his scenario? I assume it would be less radioactive, of course, or maybe it wouldn't.
You don't know because the events will occur when we start running out that are completely unpredictable. Things will get out of hand.
And it could certainly include, so there'd be a sort of a double feature there.
That's
between
right.
Your future and his,
yep,
sort of brought together. All right, engage a little bit in this idea. I've got a phrase here on the questionnaire. It says pre-car world, post-car world. Until 1900, it was a pre-car world. What kind of shape do you think a world could take that was post-car, that didn't rely on so much of this individual transportation by...
Well, it's not necessarily true that if we do this in a rational way,
right,
we don't have to give up transportation.
Okay.
Because you can use electricity to make hydrogen. You can use hydrogen either as a fuel itself or to make other fuels. You can imagine, if we lived in a rational world,
right,
getting from where we are now to getting to a world where, without any fossil fuels at all, we had all the same transportation, all the same convenience, and so on.
And so we could keep our car-centric culture, of course, has been evolving itself.
We could. We might want to modify that. I don't know exactly what the nature of the future will be, but
right,
we don't have to give it up completely.
Okay. I interviewed officer of a company that's looking for diamonds in Canada with satellites and grid computing. Are there similar advanced technologies for finding more oil? And if there are, will it make any difference?
Look, we for 150 years, oil geologists have gone to the ends of the earth searching for oil.
Right.
The only unexplored places on Earth are the the South China Sea, where seven countries have overlapping claims to the same mineral rights. Central Siberia, which has huge access problems, and the deep oceans, which have huge drilling problems.
Right.
And so, no, I don't think that kind of technique is going to find. And even if we did, you know, if we discovered a new Middle East all over again,
right,
700 billion barrels of additional reserve, that would delay the peak by 10 years.
Which is, in the geological time span, nothing.
Exactly.
The number two solution that you've got after, if I'm right in saying it's solar energy, is nuclear power,
yes.
Fission power.
Yes.
It's been pretty controversial. They haven't built any new ones in a long time.
Yep.
Has much in the way of new technology come along to make it any safer, or is it still pretty much where it was at the time of Three Mile Island? And what about the seemingly insoluble problem of waste disposal, even if you could make the plants themselves safer, and about the reprocessing of this greatly increased amount of fuel into nuclear weapons?
Yeah. If you go on using only U-235, which is a 0.7% of the uranium, and in current day technology, and you burn it at a 10 terawatt burn rate,
right?
Okay, the known reserves would last for 1 or 2 decades.
So it's going to run out under the same principles as oil.
Yeah, that's right. You can use breeder reactors to make it 100 times more stuff.
Right.
But then you're making plutonium, and that's dangerous.
Right.
Making the world safe for plutonium is really a tall order.
Right.
You can also make thorium reactors. There's 3 times as much thorium as uranium in the Earth's crust, but we have very little experience with it. That's a huge research project.
And again, you've got to use energy to mine it.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Now there are advanced reactors that are inherently safe against the Chernobyl-type meltdown.
Right.
Scenario. They call high-temperature gas reactors, HTGRs. And so you could make safer reactors. As far as the spent fuel is concerned, I believe that's more of a political problem than a scientific problem.
Okay, so we come back to the... But I don't know, the anti-nuclear power movement is sort of quiescent, but that's, of course, because they haven't built any new plants, and they're not complaining about the ones that are there, none of which have had any serious accidents, at least that I've known about. So.
Right.
So are you thinking then that might be part of the way to go?
It has to be part of the way to go. It's not the solution, it's not a magic bullet, but it has to be part of the way to go.
And that's, as you say several times, nuclear power is a better way of providing energy for fixed objects than for moving ones.
Right, but you can use that energy to crack water to make hydrogen or...
Okay. So say a little bit about that with the fuel cells and hydrogen and all that, and whether that's a bonus source of energy or whether it's just another form of energy that can be used conveniently.
It's not a form of energy at all. It's just like electricity. You have to make it to use it.
Right.
It's a way of transporting energy.
Okay.
And hydrogen itself has real problems with it. It's got a very low volume density of energy. So you're carrying it around at extremely high pressures, for example, in a car. Makes a car very ungainly.
Right.
So chances are you'd want to use it in some other way.
Okay.
But there are a number of very clever schemes for making use of hydrogen. And so I think we'll solve the technical problems associated with hydrogen sooner or later.
All right. So essentially what you're looking for is some kind of mix of hybrid gasoline engines, solar power, electrical power from nuclear, and so on.
Yes.
Okay. Can computer technology offer any solution? And maybe say a little bit more about the plan that I had 25 years ago that says more people should travel less and telecommute more and cut down on the use of energy that way.
Yes to all of the above. What you're talking about, telecommuting, is a great idea, though. Not everybody does the kind of work that you can do by telecommuting.
You have to be a symbolic analyst.
That's right. But computers will help... In all kinds of ways. Cars will be more efficient. Hybrid cars will be more efficient. The fuel cell cars will run better because computers will be running them. And so the computer is not the solution of our problem, but it will be part of each solution of our problem.
Okay. Again, it's a multifaceted solution.
Very, very, very much so.
During the same campaign where I said compute, don't commute, I was in a debate with Pete McCloskey, who was the incumbent Republican congressman there, and we were actually in Terman Auditorium at Stanford, the one epicenter of the engineering world, and I suggested that we might want to look to to something that you talk about in the book, these NASA DOE plans for geosynchronous solar arrays in space.
Right.
Congressman McCloskey said, you are living in a fantasy world. was I? Am I now? Is there a possibility from that?
No. It may someday make some contribution. It's, again, you'd have to put up something like 800 geosynchronous Manhattan-sized collectors to give us those 10 terawatts.
More than building the Hoover Dam.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Okay. Let me just insert some poetry here. You talked about entropy and the heat death of the universe and where all that's going. In fact, the question, can entropy be reversed, was the last question in a short story that Isaac Asimov wrote in the 50s or 60s. Are you familiar with it?
Simple answer. The answer is no.
The answer is no. Well, in fact, what he has happened in that book, in that story, is that every succeeding generation of scientists asks every succeeding generation of computer the same question, the same last question: can entropy be reversed?
Yes.
And in every generation, the computer comes back with the answer and says, "Not enough data at this time." Although, of course, according to what you just said, the answer was always no, not enough data. In any case, it goes on for several millennia of generations.
I can imagine.
And in the final end, humans have become transubstantiated in some way, and there's nothing left but the computer existing in hyperspace, thinking it over. And it thinks it over for an
it sounds like Dwight Adams, actually.
It doesn't? Does he do that?
Anyway, I have a meeting that I must go to now.
And it's 2 o'clock. All right, so we won't be able to answer that question until the end of...
another millennium.
Okay, one final point. A few days ago, by some fluke, I was watching education television late at night, and on came your show, The Mechanical Universe, talking about Galileo and the trouble he had in trying to get the truth out. And it seems like scientists who have messages and political and religious institutions that have answers without questions seems to have been going on for hundreds of years.
Yes, one could make that argument.
Do you see any more likelihood that truth and science will out in this contemporary problem that we're talking about now?
I think that nothing's going to happen until we have a crisis.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
All right, I'll get in your crisis right now. You got to get to your meeting. So thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you. It was fun.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Go on.